From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, those open lines. Here's what's happening. Another earthquake, this time hits Southern California. A 7.1 magnitude earthquake hit Ridgecrest, California again. Multiple fires, some reported injuries. It comes a day after another earthquake rattled the state right at the epicenter of Ridgecrest again, 150 miles north of Los Angeles. The quake has produced more than 1,400 aftershocks, according to scientists. I felt this one along with my staff, Tom and Dan. This thing seemed to go for at least a minute, and really the building just kept shaking. Weirdest feeling I've ever felt. Now, yesterday was a 6.4. Today was a 7.1. Aaron Bender from our affiliate in Los Angeles, KFI, is with us here. Aaron, this was a big one.
It was, and it felt much bigger than the one yesterday. A 7.1 today compared to 6.4 yesterday. And I think the big difference for a lot of people, 7.1 is significantly bigger than a 6.4. I think Lucy Jones from Caltech, or was at Caltech tonight, saying that it's about maybe 10 to 15 times bigger. But this quake, from the USGS website, this quake was only a half mile deep tonight compared to yesterday's, which was about 6 miles deep. So you've got a stronger quake that was very shallow, so you're going to feel it very far away from the epicenter. That's why they felt it in Vegas. That's why they felt it close to Sacramento and in parts of Mexico.
And yesterday, they're saying now that yesterday 6.4 was really only a prelude to today.
Yeah, Lucy Jones had said yesterday that there was a 1 in 20 chance that a big quake like yesterday's 6.4 is actually just a foreshock. And she says that pretty much every time there is a large quake like this, like, there's a 5% chance, people. Don't just sleep on it. Don't just think this is the only one. Well, this was the 1 in 20. So you have today's 7.1. She says she can't remember, or that she doesn't know of any instance when, in a case like this, where maybe the 7.1 is also a foreshock.
Oh, boy.
So it looks like this is the max it's going to get. We may be experiencing a 6.0 aftershock any time now. We have had a 4.7. We've had a 5.4, a 4.9 that we felt here in Burbank, about 10 miles from where you are. And we felt it pretty good. All of these different aftershocks, we've been feeling them pretty good.
Aaron, if you're driving a car on the highway and this hits, do you feel it?
I think you feel the 7.1 in some areas. I know some people said that they were driving yesterday in the 6.4 and they felt it. And I really think it just depends on where you are, what road you're on. Are you on a freeway overpass that maybe disperses that energy a little bit better than a road that's just down the road from the epicenter? You saw highways buckling just from yesterday's 6.4.
Yeah.
You've got infrastructure inspectors looking at the highways in the Ridgecrest area tonight in the dark, trying to see if there's any kind of damage from tonight's 7.1.
Multiple fires out that way, too. A lot of it caused from gas leaks and pipes that break and some injuries reported. So let's keep prayers for everybody.
You got it, George.
All right, thanks. Aaron Bender from KFI in Los Angeles. 45 people in 13 states have been diagnosed with salmonella-related illness after coming in contact with pig ear dog treats. While the FDA and the CDC are still investigating, the Pet Supplies Plus company has recalled its bulk pig ear product. They are called pig ear treats. The CDC says it is not confirmed that any of the people who have become sick bought the pig ear treats at Pet Supplies Plus, although 12 people have been hospitalized. The treats were stocked in open bins. They were not in prepackaged pig ears parts, and they're not part of the recall. Salmonella can sicken animals that eat the products, and humans are at risk, too, if they touch them, especially if they don't wash their hands afterwards, and that apparently is what's been happening. An Iranian Revolutionary Guards commander has threatened to seize a British ship now in retaliation for the capture of an Iranian supertanker by the Royal Marines in Gibraltar. And Iran's president has warned that they will increase its enrichment of uranium to any amount they want beginning on Sunday, putting further pressure on European nations to save its faltering nuke deal and offer a way around intense U.S. sanctions. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com, with us here. John, first of all, did you feel the earthquake?
Oh, yeah, well, you know, we're only like 2 miles from where you are, and our house is suspended over the hill on, you know, we have one of those architectural homes, so we really feel it.
Well, I'm glad you're okay.
Yeah, we're fine.
Now, the situation with Iran seems to be getting more and more tense.
Oh, there's no question, George. I mean, with Iran, you know, the Revolutionary Guard Corps that Trump labeled in May as a terrorist organization, planting those limpet mines on oil tankers, highly suspected of planting them, and now threatening to seize a British tanker after their tanker 2 days ago was interdicted by British authorities on a tip from the U.S., U.S. intelligence, basically off the Strait of Gibraltar. It's now in Gibraltar holding that tanker. They will release the tanker. It was false flagged from India, Pakistan, and the Ukraine. So what you've got working right now is a situation that could be extremely volatile. Any move on the part of Iranians to seize a British tanker would automatically trigger a very strong U.S. strike against Iran. And when you stop to consider that the President Rouhani has essentially been warning and now has confirmed that Iran has scuttled the JCPOA, that's the Iran nuke deal, and is now going to be enriching uranium to weapons grade right now from basically 3.67% up to 90%.
Dangerous.
I think you've got a situation where Trump is already committed to a red line that he will not tolerate Iran's enrichment activities. I think that situation in the Gulf right now is extremely volatile.
You got it. John, thank you, and stay safe, my friend. Sunday night, Howard Bloom joins us in our news segment to talk about Israel and Iran and what he anticipates could happen there, too. Payroll growth rebounded sharply in June as the U.S. economy added 224,000 jobs. It's the best gain since January and running contrary to worries that both employment picture and the overall growth picture were beginning to weaken. So it was a great month there. Much has been written about the great mental health benefits that come with regular exercise. Now, a new study shows that hitting the treadmill every morning, even for a very short time, offers another brain benefit. It will make you smarter. Just remember that. NASA says it cannot afford to build a space telescope, considered the fastest way to identify asteroids that might hit the planet Earth. That's a shame. We should be spending some money there. President Donald Trump said in an interview with Fox News that he personally doubts that UFOs exist, but added he couldn't definitely say unidentified aircrafts are only the stuff of science fiction. But don't say that to air traffic controllers in Denver, because one left a message on a hotline answering service Sunday, June 30th of this year, a report of an apparent spherical UFO that was approximately 34,000 feet high. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center with us for his weekly report. Peter, what was that?
Isn't that an interesting report?
Sure is.
You may recall that last week I closed my report by mentioning a similar incident that had occurred on the 24th of May over Los Angeles Airport, International Airport. Well, this one sounds very, very similar, except In Los Angeles, the object was only about 2,000 feet above ground level. In this case, this sighting on Monday morning, the 30th of June, the object was at 34,000 feet, according to the crew that reported it to the FAA. It was a doozy of a report, and we have a number of these now. So I'll close my report with a similar one from SeaTac Airport just this morning. But in addition to that report from Denver, we have posted another interesting report from Alaska. An F-16 fighter pilot writes, and this one is posted to our website, George, it's featured from our homepage. In February of 1990, he was an Air Force F-16 pilot. He and a wingman were scrambled out of probably Eielson Air Force Base close to Fairbanks, and they were being guided by ground radar to intercept targets that ground radar had. They got up there, and they couldn't see anything. Finally, they did. They found three barrel-shaped or cylindrical objects about three times the size of a oil barrel, he writes. Oil drum, I guess I should say more correctly. And these objects exhibited unbelievable flight characteristics. They went from 5,000 feet or higher down to ground level in a matter of a few seconds. And after they had hovered there for a short period of time, they were seen by both pilots, both visually and on their radar, to accelerate straight up at Mach 6, they estimated the speed was, and disappear from their sight. A whole bunch of reports this week. We should have them posted to our website. I'll close with one that addresses an incident that occurred near SeaTac Airport this morning. 4 minutes past midnight this morning, gentleman was standing looking at airplanes taking off from SeaTac Airport, and his attention was drawn to, yet again, an orange spherical object, an orange ball of light that was, I think, to the west of the airport. And he writes that at one point he saw an aircraft actually maneuver, apparently, to avoid passing in proximity to it. So we're in the process of updating our website. It should be updated either tonight or tomorrow morning. These reports and many, many others are available there.
Super. Peter, thanks. We'll talk to you next week. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Up next, let's have a little fun. Mr. Lobo joins us. We'll talk about some great horror movies in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Mr. Lobo is the host of the late-night movie program Cinema Insomnia, which is a cult sensation for 18 years and stars as the amazing Criswell in the film Plan 9. He lords over late-night slumber party fun when he's not listening to Coast with his patented blend of humor and satire. Mr. Lobo is the MC for film festivals like Blobfest and provides background on films with comedy, games, prizes as well. We're going to talk about some movies. We'll take your calls next hour about them as well. Mr. Lobo, always a pleasure, my friend.
Always a pleasure, indeed. I hope everyone is all right with the giant monsters returning.
Oh, my gosh. I can't say everyone is. There have been some injuries. We don't know the extent of that yet, but unbelievable.
Oh, wow. That is terrifying. You know, I did feel, I'm in Pennsylvania, and I did feel something, but that was just because I was getting cheese out of the refrigerator, and then when I stood up, I hit my head on the freezer door and knocked the whole freezer door off.
That's not smart. You'll hurt yourself.
So forgive me if some of my trivia has been knocked out of my head tonight, but
I'll remind you.
I'm very very glad to be back on the program. I'm very glad that everyone, at least everyone in your camp, is okay after this terrible earthquake.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I just hope that's it. My God, this was a 7.1. That may be the biggest I ever go through in my life out here.
Wow.
Time to sneak back to St. Louis.
I mean, I lived in California most of my life. The first earthquake I really, really felt was in Maryland in 2011.
I was in L.A. a couple of years ago and went back to St. Louis. Had not been in an earthquake in Los Angeles. Went back to St. Louis, and I was in a 3.4. And
oh, wow.
Ended up being on CNN that night and telling them what it was like to feel. And with a 3.4, You think that's pretty extensive. 7-1 was unbelievable.
The one in Baltimore was 4-7, and that was pretty good. I mean, we could fail at driving, but I don't know about, 7-1, that sounds like something out of a movie.
It does. Now, by the time it hit us where we are, it was probably down to about a 5 in terms of strength. But still, the building, which has been built on rollers, actually was rocking back and forth. And you could hear the girders, the metal, going, it was weird. And, you think for a moment, man, this whole building's going to go down. And Danny, our operations manager, came running down, making sure everybody was okay. And it's weird. Anyways, let's talk movies. Let's have some fun now.
Have some fun.
What's out there these days?
You know, I just saw the new Godzilla movie, and I really enjoyed it. The King of Monsters that just came out.
Was that Japanese? They used to be,
right?
No, it was
an American-made movie. But Legendary Pictures has, well, Legendary, I believe, is an English company, right? But it's a Western film made recently. Recently they did a Godzilla movie a few years ago, and this is a direct sequel to the Godzilla movie from just a few years ago, only this time he's got Mothra and Rodan and King Ghidorah, and it's much more of a throwback to the movies of the 60s where he's fighting multiple monsters, and it's kind of has almost a Lovecraftian aspect to it, where they've sort of redesigned the origins of the monsters to where they're much older, that they've been here before we were, and now they're just coming back to reclaim the planet.
Now, Godzilla originally was a depiction in Japanese films, right?
Yes. 1955, Godzilla was Japanese film Gojira, and then when they brought it over to America, they simplified it as Godzilla, and then they inserted all the scenes with Raymond Burr as an American newscaster in Japan to sort of make it feel more like an American movie.
Did they create those movies, Mr. Lobo, because of the two bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the fallout with radiation?
The first film is very much allegorical to the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki from World War II.
So these Godzilla was like a mutant or something.
Yes, radioactive, basically kind of the folly of man. Sort of taking revenge, almost like the Earth taking revenge for our tampering with, things we don't understand, like nuclear power. That's kind of it's interesting because the first movie is very much a downer. I'd much rather show an audience Mothra, the first Mothra movie, than the first Godzilla movie, because it is a kind of, the first one is a very serious, I don't know about very serious, but I mean, it definitely is allegorical to the Hiroshima tragedy, which makes it a lot darker in tone.
Well, why were the horror films of those past days, the 50s, the 60s, why were they so weird?
Why were they so weird? That's a good question.
I mean, when you compare them with horror films of today, which are gory and stuff.
We permitted a lot more fantasy in our horror films. I think that there was kind of almost a mythic kind of fairy tale sort of quality that that sort of crept into a lot of those older movies. Even Frankenstein and stuff like that, they're almost fairy tales. And I think that, after the 60s, with the sort of the introduction of you've got Psycho and movies like The Exorcist, and I think a lot more real world kind of horror kind of crept into the universe of horror. But I think, especially in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, there was a lot of fantasy inserted into them. And I think also because they were more considered fair for children. I don't think horror was not considered serious entertainment. Neither was science fiction by the mainstream, even though a lot of adults, and very intelligent people were writing and producing and creating sci-fi and horror. It was very much thought of as matinee material, and I think that's why a lot of it was so weird, and why we had so many goofy, bug-eyed monsters in so many of those movies.
Well, and we didn't have a lot of television, and in those days, obviously, we didn't have cell phones, smartphones, social networking. So people's pastime was truly going to the movie houses, wasn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, you couldn't just pull it out of your pocket. You had to.
You had to go.
You had to go downtown and you know, pay your 5 cents or whatever, and sit in the dark all day, and maybe a double feature with a cartoon and a newsreel and a cereal.
Let's talk more about these when we come back with Mr. Lobo right here on Coast to Coast AM. We are back with Mr. Lobo as we talk about films, horror films in general. Mr. Lobo, you know, in the old days, they used to have all these people that we used to talk about who would host local movie intro shows, you know, the vampires and people like
sure.
that. Morgus would
the
do that
host.
And stuff. Are they doing that anymore at local stations?
They are. They are.
Perfect.
And it's an increasing thing. I think we might be on the new
trend
of a trend of the return of the horror movie hosts. You know, Sven Gulli, who was the big Chicago horror host. Originally, there was Jerry Bishop, who was Sven Gulli in the early 70s, and then Rich Kaz took over in the later 70s and into the 80s. And Rich Kaz now has been Sven Gulli for 40 years at his Chicago station. But now that Chicago station is part of MeTV, and so people across the country get to enjoy Sven Gulli on a weekly basis. So it's kind of the best kept secret is now everybody gets to see that guy. And he's still he's a Silver Age horror host who's still doing it. And Dr. Gangrene out of Tennessee, who's been semi-retired for a while, is now doing a new version of his show in Tennessee. And Joe Bob Briggs, who used to host Monster Vision on cable, has a new show on the channel Shudder, which is a horror channel. And, of course, myself, Cinema Insomnia,
I'm still doing my
show. It's our 18th year, and we're still picking up new broadcast stations. And and I'm trying to think who. Oh, and Elvira, I think, is doing something for October where she's hosting a series of movies out of Salem, Massachusetts for Halloween.
So we lost Sir Graves Ghastly out of Detroit.
I know, and he was wonderful.
Yeah,
he was one
was
of our
fun.
Best. Very popular in Cleveland, but he was syndicated to a lot of other areas.
That's right.
Did you watch him in Cleveland?
I watched him in Detroit.
Detroit,
and he got syndicated. He was working for the company that owned our station, Storer Broadcasting, at the time, and they syndicated him out of Toledo and Cleveland and Detroit, and
he was on in Virginia also. Yeah, he was widespread because he was so darn good.
And you remember my buddy Morgus, right, Dr. Morgus?
Dr. Morgus, absolutely. Morgus the Magnificent, yes. And he did the Wacky World of Dr. Morgus, which I believe was probably the first movie to ever feature a horror host character. And he broadcast from the old Ice House, right?
That's right. Exactly. And he was telling Tom and me some time ago that he believes that the character that Jerry Lewis had in The Nutty Professor was based on a script that he had written that he thinks somebody saw and took the character.
I do believe that.
Yeah, I do too.
Dr. Morgus is very much Nutty Professor, I would think.
Absolutely. The teeth and everything.
Yeah, I think Jerry Lewis, you know, I would be very surprised if it was just something that was in the zeitgeist and it was a complete accident. I mean, supposedly with the Addams Family and the Munsters, that they were unaware of each other and that those two things just happened spontaneously at the same time. But that rarely happens. I think there's a lot of theft in Hollywood, for sure.
Do we have any more Bela Lugosi, Lon Chaney's, Vincent Price's around anymore?
You know, people like to draw that line in the sand. I remember when it was just the old great ones, right? You know, there was never going to be another, Lon Chaney. You know, and then okay, well, we'll give you Bela and Karloff, but after that, no, there's going to be nobody.
God, I forgot about Boris Karloff.
All right, now Vincent Price. Okay, but after Vincent Price, there's nobody. But you know what? We had Peter Cushing in the 70s, and I think even like Donald Pleasence in the Halloween films, I think he's marvelous. You know, and I think Ian Holm, who was an alien. A lot of these guys, you know, even like Lance Henriksen, I think of him as a great horror actor. He's been in hundreds of movies, you know. So I think that time, you know, it's like a fine wine. I think a lot of these actors that we've seen in 50 100 movies, you know, they'll start having their, people will start recognizing them. I think the big problem today is that we're not giving them the fun roles. We don't have a lot of people playing Dr. Jekyll. We don't have a lot of people playing Frankenstein or the monster or Dracula. And so, and you know, now we're kind of in this area where we are doing all these reboots and reimaginings and adaptions. So I think that, you know, if you have people playing some of these classic characters, I think we will have another Vincent Price or another Peter Cushing or Bela or Karloff. You just got to give them good horror roles to do.
That's true. What do you think of Robert Englund playing the part of Freddy Krueger?
I think Robert Englund is an excellent horror actor, and certainly he definitely it would be considered one of the great ones of the more modern era. You know, and he's been in science fiction films like V. And a lot of other things. So, I mean, he's been in hundreds of projects. He's a great actor. And I know they tried to do a Billy Bob Thornton or someone. They tried to do a reboot with someone else's Freddy Krueger, and nobody accepted that. So
we like the originals, don't we?
Absolutely. Yeah, sure. I know when Elvira did that reality show where she was looking for her replacement, that fell flat because nobody wants to imagine someone else's Elvira.
Absolutely. Now, you've been touring the country, making appearances?
I have been. We did 2 months on the road, and we visited a lot of people across the country and a lot of friends and fans from over the years. And we filmed some new sequences for the season. And we did 2 live shows in San Leandro at the Bow Theater, which I know you have appeared
at. I've been there. Absolutely.
And
San Leandro, California.
Yeah, yes. In San Leandro, yes. And Dan Dillman gives his regards, the manager of the Bow Theater.
Good guy.
And, yeah, he is a great guy. And so, we did 2 live shows there with an audience, and just we did the TV show complete with all the commercials and breaks and the pieces of the film, and everyone got to experience what it's like to be on set for Cinema Insomnia in a theater environment. And we did Sinister Creature Con, which is a great horror convention out there. And we did a sci-fi, the Intergalactic Expo in West Sacramento, which was another really fun event. And I got to interview some of the original Star Wars people. And we did some psychotronic film festivals, which is basically kind of everything but the kitchen sink, where they show old school films and trailers and, you know, weird industrials and anything you can think of all mixed together into one program along with horror and sci-fi stuff. And it's a lot of fun, a lot of nostalgia. And so we just had a great time, did a lot of stuff. And then a friend of mine showed me some really weird stuff. He's a museum director, and I guess the museum's jurisdiction, they kind of had this house that was run by this guy named Doc Jansen, who made a local museum dedicated to the town, and he kept like weird, you know, old bird's nests and photos of local residents and things like that. But he also had, he'd have like pictures of what he thought were of diagrams of Christian UFOs. He had these theories of Christian UFOs.
A lot of people do.
Yeah, it was very fascinating. I mean, we were in his house until 2 in the morning. He was just showing me all sorts of things that this guy collected, and and they want to kind of try to present this guy's house because the guy was trying to turn his house into a museum. And the guy had ventriloquist dummies. I guess he did these sort of Bible shows I'm scared of ventriloquist dummies. So they had a whole closet.
And I don't like clowns. So we'd make a great pair going out.
They had a whole closet full of ventriloquist dummies that were made by the guy who made Charlie McCarthy. And so there was so many interesting, and there was a stuffed boxer, you know, the dog, a boxer. They had one that was made into a rug and another one that was stuffed. And it was so many interesting things. And they're like, how do we present this? And it's like, well, you know, I don't know if I would present the guy as a crackpot. I would do it like Ripley's Believe It or Not and just say, look, here was this local resident. He wanted to make his house a new museum. He wanted people to come in here and see all his stuff. Why don't you come in here and see his stuff and make up your own mind as to how you feel about this guy?
That was Edgar Bergman. Who
yes.
came up with Charlie
McCarthy? Bergman, yes, Candace Bergen's Father.
That's right. Yeah. Isn't it amazing, though, those things that really got people to watch television and do things in those days? Remember Kukla, Fran, and Ollie and all those things?
Kukla, Fran, and Ollie, yes. And,
would they work today? They wouldn't make it today, would they?
What's interesting is I was looking at Mystery Science Theater, and I was looking at their shadows in the theater there, and I'm thinking, that looks like Kukla, Fran, and Ollie to me. I think they're just doing that same thing in a modern way.
I mean, the Muppets have made it.
The Muppets, yeah. They canceled the new series that they tried to do, but, you know, they're constantly trying to, you know, I bet you in another 2 years they'll have another movie or another series. And now that Disney owns them, they'll never let that go.
Did you also watch a lot of the old dramatic science fiction type television shows, like One Step Beyond, Science Fiction Theater, Twilight Zone, all that?
Yes. Absolutely. One Step Beyond was amazing with John Newland. Some of those were interesting because some episodes were totally documentary, you know, where he would go down to some South American village and figure out.
It was like In Search Of, way before In Search Of.
Proto In Search Of, right. And then some episodes were completely dramatic where a woman thought she was shrinking or whatever. And then, of course, Twilight Zone, those were really, speaking of fairy tales, they were all kind of moral, modern sort of Aesop's fables that were very socially aware and intelligent. And we've got, I haven't seen any of the new ones, but they've just rebooted the Twilight Zone and supposedly they're very socially aware and intelligent. Scripts. I haven't seen any of the new ones yet, though.
You're looking at John Wick 3 too. You think it's too violent?
That's not sci-fi. It's not. It almost is, though, because this is a movie about a hidden world, a world of assassins, and they have their own currency and their own doctors and their own, like, it's just beneath the surface. Like, if you go down the wrong alley, you're suddenly in this totally different world. And that was very fascinating how they kind of expanded upon this world where this sort of criminal underground led by something called the High Table. So it's somewhat fantastic in the way that it's, you know, it has a lot of imagination to it, more than just a normal movie about an assassin would. But I enjoyed the film. You know, again, I'm used to horror films, and I saw the violence as almost comedic because it was so constant. But I mean, it is wall to wall killing in this movie. I mean, it's almost like I said, it's so over the top that it's almost comedic. He kills a guy with a book. He kills a he can put his hands on, he can kill you with it. I think it's a good vehicle for Keanu Reeves because he hardly talks in the movie. So a lot of people think there's no story happening because there's not a lot of dialogue, but there is a lot visually happening. And again, they really expand this sort of idea of an underground criminal world that we've never seen before. That's super fantastic. So anyway, that's all I'm going to say about it. I enjoyed it. I thought, like I said, I was laughing at it because it was so over the top violence wise, but there were some people next to me who were very offended by the violence. And so that was something that I noted, and I thought it might be worth talking about, I think dropping into a third movie without seeing the first and the second, you know, this one I feel is just setting up a fourth movie, so they're just fighting and getting characters in place for this fourth movie. So there isn't really a whole lot of story in this one, but it was super violent.
Just talking about how I didn't like clowns, and they've got this new movie coming out again, the sequel to It.
Ugh. Yes, It Chapter 2, which the trailer just dropped for, and that, they're going to have a big problem, I think, with that movie.
Really? How come?
Well, I just think that everyone really was charmed by the children of the first movie, and now they're all grown up.
Uh-huh.
So, this whole movie, we're going to have to, you know, these are going to be, even though they're supposed to be the same people, you know, we're supposed to accept them as the children from the first movie, and I feel like if they can't sell that, I think it's going to be very hard. I think seeing a monstrous clown from a child's perspective is terrifying. And the fantastic, you know, when you're a child, you have that sense of wonder, and something like that seems more plausible. I think having a bunch of adults fighting a giant clown might not play as well in a movie, but we'll see.
Tom loves foreign horror films. What do you think about The Curse of the La Llorona?
La Llorona. I loved it. I thought it was very well done. You know, there was, it's a real legend from, I believe, the 1800s, where a woman who's very jealous of her husband. Her husband has an affair with a younger woman, and out of revenge, she drowns her own children.
Oh, God.
In a river. And then now she's a ghost and she's stealing people's children. That's the curse.
That's scary.
It is scary, and it was very well done, and with a lot of restraint. You don't see a whole lot, and it was actually a little too classy to be in the Conjuring / Annabelle universe, which it is kind of connected to those other films.
Annabelle was an interesting movie.
I liked it. I liked the second one, which is a prequel, better. And this third one is supposed to be, I guess, more about the Warrens, you know, famously associated with the Amityville Horror.
This right.
is supposed to be the doll. I guess the their daughter, I guess, and some of her friends are sort of watching the house while they're away, and the Annabelle doll is in there, in that huge cache of forbidden items that's supposedly under the Warren's house, you know. I don't know if Annabelle gets loose or tries to tempt them into setting her free, but that's the premise of that movie.
How would you categorize that movie, the Chucky doll, that one, Chucky?
Oh, yeah, Child's Play.
Yeah.
It was the original Child's Play movie, which, you know, there was a children's toy called My Buddy, which was almost like, it was a doll that was almost the size of a child that, you know, could do anything, and they just figured, you know, hey, this is really creepy, why don't we make a horror movie where one of these comes to life? And so the very first movie is fairly simple, where you have a convict's soul somehow trapped possessing a doll, and you know, they've been doing these possessed doll movies since the 30s, you know, and interesting, more modern take on it. But then Chucky became almost, I think they groomed him to become another Jason or Freddy, where they did many, many, the Child's Play movies morphed into just the Chucky movies, where it was the doll.
And it was good, just as a Chucky movie.
As a serial killer, yeah, and those, you know, some of those are good, and then some of the later ones are actually pretty funny.
Let's take some calls with you, Mr. Lobo, when we come right back. Get ready to make the calls with Mr. Lobo on Coast to Coast AM.